At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Keith L. from Ocala, Florida.
My name's Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm delighted to be back with a specific group. I was born in Ohio. That's where Alcoholics Anonymous started. I know you know that, but I say that in case there's anybody here from California. You know, I love your tradition of all these people spitting on a cake, then you all eat it. You know, I was born in a small town, Martins Ferry, Ohio, by the steel mills and the coal mines and all that stuff. And I was surrounded by absolutely magnificent human beings. My parents were the most spiritual, character-ridden human beings I ever met in my life. And we grew up in material poverty, but I had the privilege of growing up in incredible spiritual wealth. You know, as a family, we prayed together every day, and, we didn't have a family car or anything like that. And my parents were just absolutely magnificent. And I was born absolutely loaded with fear. When I was a little kid, I knew there was something under my bed. I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed, and then I'd be history. And I couldn't tell anybody that I was afraid. And my fear came out in defiance, even as a kid. You know, I like to talk about my first drinking experience. My father was watching myself and my brother, Denny. I'm the eldest son in a family of 10 children, and I had a sister 2 years older than me, and my mother was either at the bingo or having a baby, and my father was watching us, and he gave us each a beer. My brother Denny was 4 and I was 5, and I drank it and nothing happened to me, but Denny had a spiritual awakening. He was rolling around under the table singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs. And my father put us to bed. And I never forget this. Denny stood up in his crib and he urinated on the floor. And I'm thinking, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol whose life has become unmanageable. And, you know, he never made it. It was awful. He had such a good start. And he went on and did some really weird things. He went to one university. He had one major. He graduated in 4 years. I never heard of such a thing. He went to one graduate school, and he was offered 8 jobs, and he took one. And he retired as a senior vice president with a large corporation. And the strangest thing of all is he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he let it slip through his fingers. I had to work at this thing. And, I was a very fear-ridden, defiant kid. And when I was in high school, whenever I got into trouble, I always served detention in the library. And what we had to do is make rosary beads, and they'd send them to the missions. And I was such a defiant little jerk that I, instead of putting 10 beads in each decade, I put 11 in. And so because, during the 4 years, there were 100 of mutant rosary beads all over the world. And I had to tell Sister Victoria, who was the librarian, what I had been doing, because it would have been like wasting 4 years of my life. So I said to her, you know what I've been doing the last 4 years? She said, yes, you sly little prince. She said, you've been putting extra beads in all the rosaries, and I know why. And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I haven't the foggiest idea why I do these things. And she said, people all over the world are saying extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit. Don't you just hate people like that? And I also started my own gang in high school, and all the good names were taken. And so we were studying the great composers, we were studying Wolfgang Mozart, so we became Mozart's Wolfgang. And we knocked a convenience store off across the street from a high school. Actually, we stole a watermelon from in front of the store. And during the course of the day, all five of us snuck over and paid for the watermelon. And the old man who ran the store used to sell us our cigarettes and everything. He said to me, he got us all together the next morning, and he said, "Boys, give it up. You're no good at being bad." And I know it was because of the way we were raised. And when I graduated from high school, I did my very first inventory. I'll never forget this. I stood in front of the mirror, and I took my shirt off, and I flexed my muscles, and I turned sideways and stuck my chest out. I was 5 feet 2 inches tall, and I weighed 115 pounds. I was a born killer, so I went and joined the Marine Corps. And I wasn't yet 18 years of age, so the recruiter showed up at our house because my parents had to sign the papers. And my mother burst into tears. My father said, "Son, are you sure you want to do this?" I said, "Dad, I thought this over a long time. 15 minutes I thought about it." And so he reluctantly signed the papers. And I'll never forget, all night my mother's crying, saying, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." And the next morning, we took a taxi cab over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and I got on a Greyhound bus and went to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Second longest trip I'd ever been on. It was 60 miles. Once I went to Cleveland, but the game was rained out. It was a bad year, and they took you if you had a pulse. I had my first drinking experience the day I was sworn into the Marine Corps. And I'll never forget, the three guys from Pittsburgh also joined. And they said, "Hey, kid, we're going to go to this place, and, you know, we have 10 hours before the train leaves. And we're going to go to this place and have a sandwich and a few beers." And I thought, me too. I'd never had a drink before, except when I was five, had one beer. We walked into this bar in Pittsburgh. I'll never forget it. It was filled with real men, you know, the kind. And they all had real women with them. You know, real women used to hang around with real men, and guys like me used to get what was left. The bartender came over and said, "What do you want?" And I thought, oh, my God, a quiz. I didn't know how to answer, so I did what they did. I ordered a beer. And then he came back, and he asked the same question, and they gave him the same answer, and so did I. And then he came back the third time and said, "What do you boys want?" I said, "We want four beers." I'd become a leader between the second and third beer. I'll never forget. I stood up, and I looked around the place, and a bunch of pathetic, snibbling little men, and all of them had women with them looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And I went from table to table filling them in on life, and I didn't know anything about anything. So we drank for hours, and the next morning I wake up in a Pullman coach that the Marine Corps had provided for me, and someone had wet the floor I was lying on, and whoever had done it had wet me too. So we're in Washington, D.C., and I changed my clothes, and I got off the train, and a guy said, "Where you been?" I didn't share. So they said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to find something to drink." So early in the morning, I began to drink, and I drank on a train clear down to Yamasee, South Carolina. If you haven't been there, I wouldn't bother. I fell off the train, and there was a very rude man there to greet us called a drill instructor. He was hurling obscenities at us, and I got up and I said, "Look, pal," I said, "if you treat us with respect, you'll get a lot more from us." And I was very drunk, say you can learn from every experience. And what I learned is you can do a lot of push-ups drunk, and you can do push-ups and throw up at the same time. The next morning they put us on a bus and took us to Paris Island, and I must tell you, I absolutely fell in love with it. I won Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award off of Paris Island and everything. And every promotion I ever got in the military was a meritorious promotion. I was going to spend 50 years in the Marine Corps if they let me, because I just loved it. It just made sense to me because the rest of the life I guessed at, but I always knew what they expected of me. And so what happened was in 1965, I'm in Santo Domingo, and I lead a combat patrol in a blackout. And, you know, the Cubans came up, and we went, they sent the Marines in the 82nd Airborne down to drive them out. And 12 of us were killed, but nobody was killed or hurt on this thing I led, because, and I was offered a commission, and I turned it down, and I took my discharge, and I got out. And when I got out, all my men, I had a section, and all my men gave me this tie tack, Marine Corps tie tack that I frequently wear. And many of them died in Vietnam. And I had terrible survivor's guilt for the longest kind of time. Then I end up marrying some unfortunate woman. And she married this alcoholic. And we had our first daughter, Kelly. And Kelly was a magnificent little girl. And then we have our second child. And I'm passed out on the living room floor in my underwear watching a test pattern on TV. I feel bad for alcoholics today because they have cable. But we used to watch a test pattern. And my wife couldn't wake me up, and a baby decided to come. And so she called the neighbors over, and they threw water on me. And I finally got up, and in an absolute rage, I drove her to the hospital I worked in, Georgetown University Hospital. And I demanded they take care of her. And, you know, I had gotten so spiritually sick as a result of this disease that I no longer believed in miracles. I grew up with parents who talked about miracles all the time. And now what had used to be a miracle now became a coincidence. And what a coincidence. This, our little baby's born 3 months premature. She weighs barely over a pound. And the chief resident in a neonatal nursery came to me. And she was a girl I'd gone to high school with back in Ohio. What a coincidence. And she said, we ordered an experimental machine. It's a negative respirator. It was the first one on the East Coast. And she said, it arrived 3 days ago, and we put it together yesterday. I'd like to put your baby on it. What a coincidence. You know, and here I am. I supervise the genetics laboratories at Georgetown University Hospital. And I sat in my office at night with the lights out and the door slightly ajar, watching this little girl struggle for every breath of life. And I watched my wife walk up and down a hallway in a state of shock. And the third night, which is particularly critical for these kids, I watched my wife go in and baptize our little baby because they didn't think she'd live through the night. And I had long since given up on God, even though I was raised in a very, very religious, spiritual family. And in an utter, and I knew what to do because I watched my father do things. He'd have gone in and put his arm around his wife, and he said, Pat, with God, we can do anything. It's going to be okay. God's plan is always perfect. That's what he used to say. And I knew what to do, but I just didn't have anything left inside of me to do it. Alcohol had taken all the character that had been built in me and destroyed it. And so in an utter panic, I ran down to the chapel in the hospital, and I got on my knees and begged God to let my little girl live. I said, if you let her live, I'll do anything. If you let her live, I will never drink again. And I was drunk in 12 hours. I drank when I thought drinking will kill my little girl. That's how powerless I was over the next drink. And one of my favorite philosophers is a guy named Blaise Pascal, a Frenchman. And he said, God created man in his own image. Unfortunately, man returned a favor. And I had created a God who would kill a little girl because her dad was sick. And that's not the God I serve today. And she didn't die. She lived. And she went on to become, I was told she'd be retarded if she lived because of lack of oxygen. And she ended up being an honor graduate from Auburn University. And I like to tell her, I think you can be an honor graduate from Auburn and be retarded. And you know, she was pregnant with her second child. She lives in Alabama. And I was speaking in Pensacola, Florida. And And I called her up, and she was crying. And I said, "What's the matter, sweetheart?" She said, "Daddy, I have kidney stones, and it's causing contractions, and I'm afraid my little girl's going to come early. I'm afraid she'll be just like me." And I said, "If she's just like you, you'll be the luckiest mother in the world." And an AA friend loaned me her car, and I drove 3 hours, and I held my little girl in my arms, and we cried together and we prayed together. And her little girl was born perfectly normal. And, you know, then I end up, my wife threw me out, of course, because I'm falling asleep with cigarettes and starting fires, and she's terrified of the, you know, that the little girls are going to die. And so I ended up where I needed to go. I ended up living in a basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. And on May the 13th, 1973, I walked into what passed for a bathroom. I had a whole medicine cabinet full of drugs. I never took drugs. But some of you think that's the saddest story you ever heard. But but I was afraid of them. And I thought if God made anything better than alcohol, he kept it for himself. And so I went in there, and I could take whatever I wanted from the hospital, and I had a whole medicine cabinet full. And I went in to commit suicide because my life was over. And I screamed out loud, "You're 29 years old, at least it'll be over." And I heard a woman's voice. She said, "It's starting." And I was startled, and my head cleared up, and I immediately remembered I had a phone number, and I called her. It was a little treatment center out on the Potomac River, a place called Seneca House. And they said they could take me in 3 days. So I detoxified on my own. I flopped around on the floor. I did all kinds of things. And then I got in a car 3 days later, and I'm driving out there. And it took me 5 hours to drive 30 miles because now they call them anxiety attacks. They used to call them running fits. And I was absolutely terrified. And, you know, I'm getting out of the car, and I'm throwing up, and I wet my pants and everything, and I'm changing my pants on the side of the road outside of Washington, D.C., and my Phi Theta Kappa key fell out of my pocket, and I wonder what happened to the kid with all the potential. We know that alcohol dissolves in potential. And so I got there, and they put me on a bus and took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked up, and there was a greeter very much like here. And a man shook my hand, and he said, "Son, I'm glad you're here." He said, "You never have to drink again." And I wanted to say to him, "Look, pal, I'm a guy who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his little girl." But he did know me. But more importantly, he knew you. And he knew that you had exactly what I needed. And then I'm sober about 2 weeks, and all my defense mechanisms have fallen apart, and I just hated myself. You know, I remembered many of the things that had happened. For example, my little girl Kelly was 5 months old, and she was very sick, and I was out of booze, so I left her and went to the liquor store. And then I also remembered that one day I woke up, and my wife had a black eye. And, you know, I was taught by my parents never, never to abuse a woman in any way. And I did it in a blackout. And it was horrible. And all this stuff happened to me. And I go to this meeting, and I'm sober 2 weeks now. And this guy said, "How's it going?" And I said, "I don't deserve this." And he said to me, "You know, son, if your head hits a pillow tonight, you haven't had a drink. Today you're a winner." And I blew him off and went to the meeting. And then I went back to the little treatment center. I was in a cot up in the attic. And I laid down and my head hit the pillow, and those words came back, and I burst into tears. And to this day, 33 years and 2 months later, whenever my head hits a pillow at night, I'm absolutely overwhelmed with gratitude because I've been given another gift, another day of sobriety. That's the greatest gift in my life. And, you know, the old timers were so wonderful to me. The man who brought Alcoholics Anonymous to Washington, D.C., and he's the guy when they wrote the big book, you know, and they were going to call it The Way Out, he went to the Library of Congress and he told Bill, "There were already 12 books named that. Yours would be the 13th. And And, you know, when I was sober about a little over 30 days, my sponsor took me to meet this man. He's on his deathbed. And this changed my life dramatically because the guy took my hand and he smiled and he had tears in his eyes. He said, "I'm so glad you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's a guy who's dying and he's thinking about me, not about himself." And it changed my life. And, you know, about a month later, you know, we know that 3 months is a very difficult time. And I got very defiant and everything, and I always went to my home group. I went to 10 meetings a week for the first couple of years I was sober. And there was a guy who led the meeting on the second step. His name was Harold B. We called him Happy Harold. And we always used to go for coffee after meetings. And we went for coffee, and my head was running like crazy, and I, you know, couldn't think, and it was just crazy. And I got up to leave, and if you read AA Comes of Age, Bernard Smith, the first chairman of the board of Alcoholics Anonymous, gives a perfect description on page 276 of what fellowship is all about. And one of the things he says is that we know one another well enough that when we look at each other, we know when something's wrong. So I'm walking by Happy Harold's table, and he reached out and took me by the arm. He said, "Son, you look troubled." And I said, "I feel guilty." And he said, "I know how you feel." And then he told me a story that changed my life. He told me that his mother was dying in intensive care. And she called him up and said, "Harold, I want you to come and see me, but don't be drinking because I don't want to go into eternity seeing my oldest boy drunk." And he said, "The next morning I went to the hospital and he said I was drunk." I said, "You were?" He said, "Hadn't met you people. I didn't know how not to be drunk." And he said his brothers and sisters said, "Harold, you can't go up there like that." So he had them call, and they took a phone to his mother in the intensive care unit. And he said, "Mama, can I come and see you?" And she said, "Are you drinking, boy?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am." And so he said, "I sat in a waiting room, and my mother died, and I never got to say goodbye to her." And I said, "How do you live with that?" And he smiled at me. You know, Harold's an African-American man, and he smiles with his whole body. I mean, he's just an incredible man. And he said, "The worst thing you do will become your greatest gift." And it changed my life. And I went home, and my head cleared up and all this stuff. And a couple of months later, I'm into the hospital, and I see Harold by the elevator. And we went over and talked for a few minutes and shook hands. And he got on the elevator and left, and I turn around, and the nurse is standing there and said, "Do you know Mr. B?" I call him, I won't use his last name. And I said, "You mean Happy Harold?" And he said, "Yeah." And she said, "He's the finest man we know." She said, "Whenever we have someone here who's alone and they're dying and they don't have anybody, we call Harold, and he comes and helps him die." And those words rang through my head: "The worst thing you do becomes your greatest gift." That was before hospice was invented. And to this day, Harold's very, very active in Alcoholics Anonymous in Washington, D.C. And he's well into 40 years of sobriety. And he's absolutely a wonderful man. And I tell you, the old man I knew taught me so much with humor. And one guy told me one time, he said, "You know, you're really deluded." And I was very offended. And so I went to this old-timer, and I said to him, I said, "Somebody said I'm deluded." And he said, "Well, that's what it says in a big book." And I said, "What's that mean?" He said, "Delusion ain't what you don't know. It's knowing things that just ain't so." He said, "We call them old ideas." And you know, all these people made huge differences in my life. And I got a sponsor, and his name was Dan. And I figured sponsorship out. They find out what you really want to do and tell you you can't do it. And, you know, I'd received an invitation from a man in Paris, France, to go study chromosomal banding with him. And I knew that Dan wouldn't let me do it. Because here I am, I'm sober like 3 months. And so I showed him the letter. We went to lunch and I showed him the letter. And he beamed and he said, "This is wonderful." I said, "You mean I can go?" He said, "You have to go." He said, "This isn't about you. This is about Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, we have 4 months to prepare you to go to France to study. And he said, and he told me something. He said, you can do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if you prepare properly. So we did the steps, and we did all these things. And he was an absolutely magnificent man. And here I am, New Year's Eve, 1974. I'm landing at Orly Airport. I'm glad I'm sitting next to the bulkhead, because I put my head against the bulkhead, and the tears were streaming down my cheeks. Because 7 months before, I'm dying on Skid Row. And here I am walking the streets of Paris, a free man. And, you know, another thing that happened around 90 days for me was I started feeling all this defiance. And I know that fear drives defiance. And so I, you know, my major in college was philosophy. And there's something called a prudent man theory or a prudent woman theory. And what I did was I thought about that, and I said, you know, if the old timers are right and I'm wrong, I'm going to die. If I'm right and they're wrong, I'll have saved some money. So I made up my mind I was going to do everything I was told to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I'm going to do this for 6 months. And I got out my calendar and I circled January the 14th, 1974. I still have that calendar to this day. And here I am walking down the Champs-Élysées in Paris. And I take the thing out and I look and I see that red circle and I burst into tears. I sat on a curb and wept because I did everything I was told to do for those 6 months. And my life was dramatically different. And, you know, the funniest thing is my sponsor happened to show up in Paris. And he spent a week with me. And then when I finished studying there, I went to Rome and spent 3 weeks in a monastery. It was just great. But in Rome, they only had one AA meeting a week then. But every day, I went to the American embassy. And a number of the people in the embassy were in AA. And so I spent time with them every day that I was in Rome. You know, we either had coffee or lunch or did something. And we had our own meeting, you know. But it was, I to this day, I remember the address of that meeting. It was 13 Via Napoli. you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has done so much in my life. It's absolutely amazing. And you know, I was sober about 11 months, and my sponsor and I used to, we answered the phones on Monday night from 7 till 10 at the intergroup office. He said to me one day, he said, you know what causes confusion? And I said, what's that? He said, you don't define your problems. He said, you know, and he said to me, how are you doing financially? I said, I'm hopelessly in debt. And he said, only the United States government is hopelessly in debt. Then he told me, he said, I want you to do a budget. And he said, and then I want you to list the checks you write every month, and I want you to list them by priority. And so I did the budget, and the next Monday night I showed him, and I listed the checks by priority. Rent, food, gasoline, cigarettes. And then number 5 was child support. And he circled child support, and he drew it up to the top. And he said, I want you to write this check first because your moral obligation is to support your children. So I started doing that. And, you know, the next morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings. And the people who ran the treatment center asked me if I would come out once. I was $100 a month in a hole. And, you know, in 1974, that was a lot of money. So I'm $100 a month in a hole, and this guy says to me, would you do one lecture a week on the effects of alcohol on the brain and the nervous system? And I said, yes, I will. And he said, we'll pay you $25 a week. So that was $100, right? And then I go to the hospital, and the chairman, Dr. Paul Bruns, he's gone now, but he was a paratrooper. He was a doctor who paratrooped in to D-Day. And He was an amazing man. I didn't know it, but he was a member of the fellowship. He was sober 9 years then, but he didn't tell me. And he said to me, he said, "I'm really, really grateful that you're doing what you're doing with your life." He said, "You're the best employee I have, and I just love you, and I love what you're doing." And he said, "I'd love to give you a raise, but I can't because there was a wage and price freeze in effect." So he said, "But I'll give you this." And he gave me a full scholarship to Georgetown University. And then I went down, and my boss, who had prayed me, he was a priest who had his PhD in genetics, had it in philosophy, had it in theology. And unfortunately, the 13th of this month, he passed away. I had sent him a 33-year token. Every year I send a token to somebody who had a major impact in my life who are not in the fellowship. And I tell them the story. And I used to send it to my parents every year, and I'd recall a story that they taught me a principle and a lesson. They blamed themselves for my alcoholism. They ought to blame themselves for my sobriety. So what happened was this man gave me all these free chits for books, and I never paid for a book when I did my work. And then I got a call from the admissions office, and this lady, brother, needed to work in a laboratory for 3 months so he could get into medical school. And right after I got sober, I hired him, and she said, "You're a veteran, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, but my veteran benefits have expired. My education benefits have expired." She said, "Today, President Ford signs a bill that extends you Vietnam-era veterans' education benefits." So I went from $100 a month in a hole to $400 a month ahead. And, you know, had I not defined the problem, I would have still felt as though I was hopelessly in debt. And that's what sponsorship is all about. To this day, my sponsor, John H. from Hilton Head Island, helps me define my problem. And I do everything he tells me to do. And, you know, Sandy B. became my sponsor about 3 years later. And he's such a wonderful man. And he lives only about 150 miles from me. He lives over in Tampa, Florida, Tampa Bay. And I live in Ocala, Florida now. But he was just magnificent. And he took me through the steps again and did all kinds of things. And, you know, I'm sober 3 years. And my little girls, who were 3 and 4 when I got sober, are now 6 and 7. And they came to me and they said, "Daddy, would you please stop smoking?" And I was terrified because I loved to smoke. And I had Cuban cigars because a friend of mine did legal work for the Russian embassy, and he'd always give me these. And I had pipe tobacco delivered to my house every month, and always had 2 or 3 cartons of cigarettes. Of course, back then, you know, cigarettes only cost 25 cents a pack in Washington, D.C. But I went to my sponsor, to Sandy, and I said, "You know, I did so much damage and I caused so much chaos in their life that I want to do something for them. I want to stop smoking." So he put a plan together for me, and we both prayed for 30 days. And at the end of 30 days, I stopped smoking. And this October, it'll be 30 years. And to this day, my little girls, they're big girls now, they tell me, "Daddy, you showed us an adult can do anything." And so I changed the chaos in their life. I've been through the steps numerous times, of course. And there are difficult times in sobriety. 3 months, 18 months, 3 years, 6 years, 10 years. 20 years and 30 years. And each time I'm in one of those difficult phases, I do the fourth and fifth step again. And you can't do too much. You know, it's all about being different every year. You know, if I'm the same guy this time next year, I've wasted a year that you and God have given me. And one of the best advice that Sandy ever gave me was, he said, "I want you to go back to the church of your childhood." He said, "Great healing takes place if you do that." And I, in my alcoholism, I had rationalized how wrong these religious people were. And when I put my eighth step together, my eight-step list, Sandy had me write out each name and each organization on a 3x5 card. And he said, every morning, when you go through the cards, pray for the ability to forgive everybody everything. And he told me, he said, the eighth step is one of the most difficult steps there is. But if you forgive everybody everything, you're going to be okay. And, you know, 8 months ago, I got rid of the last card. It was a girl I dated in high school. She never saw me drink. And she sent me a Dear John when I was in the Marine Corps. And my theory was, if you didn't get a Dear John in the military, you didn't have a girlfriend when you left. And I went home, and I was drunk, and she had never seen me drink. And I was a monster. I screamed, and I did all kinds of things, and hurt her feelings, and did all kinds of things. And I was going to make amends to her, but Sandy said, don't do that. She's married. All you can do is cause trouble. And I ran into her brother, and he's in the same field I'm in. He's a hospital administrator, too. And he told me that she had been divorced. So I told my wife I was going to call her and make my last amends. And she said to me, she said, you were always a perfect gentleman when we were in high school, but that night you were a monster. And her father was a drunk, too. So it terrified her. And I was finally made my last amends. But, you know, one of the things on my list, I had religious people, because I hated religious people. I always got a big kick out of it when a religious person failed, you know. So what I did was I told Sandy, I said, I'm going to go down to the retreat center. There's a Jesuit retreat center. And I'm going to go find this young theologian because he'll understand the significance of this magnificent thing I'm about to do. Sandy said, why don't you ask God to direct you to the right person? So I'm down there and I'm walking back and forth and there's this old priest sitting in a rocking chair reading his breviary. And I knocked on a door and I said, Father, can I talk with you for a few minutes? He said, absolutely, son. He said, come in. So I sat down and I told him my story and I told him why I was there and I told him the horrible things I had said about people like him. And he got up and he pulled me up out of the chair and he put his arms around me and he began to cry. And he said, son, God sent you. I said, excuse me? He said, God sent you. He said, because he said, I was just asking my higher power, because he knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, because he did a lot of fifth steps and things. And he said, I was just asking my higher power, where have I failed to serve you? And he said, too often I hung around with the people who agreed with me. And he said, I was supposed to go out after the ones who were lost. He said, I'm sorry you had to be out there all alone. He's crying, and I start to cry. And here I am driving back to Washington, D.C. from the eastern shore of Maryland. And I had to pull off the road a half dozen times because my eyes kept filling up with tears that God would use me. Because this priest had cancer and he told me, I get to go home soon. And God would use somebody like me to carry a message to a man who'd been the best priest he could be for 50 years. I was absolutely overwhelmed. And then, you know, the hardest amends I ever had to make was my father. Men often compete with dad, and women often compete with mom. And my dad was such a man of character. And I used to drive from Washington, D.C. to Ohio to make amends. And this rage would well up inside of me, and I'd get in a car and leave. And my dad said, I like that boy, but he drives a long way for a cup of coffee. And you know, neither my mom or dad had ever seen the ocean. And I had a little beach house, and I named the beach house CZ Does It. And it was down on Carolina Beach in North Carolina. So I took him down there. When my father retired, I took him down there. And he'd never had an automobile. Because he sent every kid in the family to college, all 10 of his children. So he never spent a dime on himself. It was always about us. It was never about him. So I took him down into my beach house and asked him to keep an eye on it for me. And they said, we will. And they kept an eye on her for 6 years. And I was given a vice presidency in a hospital corporation. And I used to travel around the Carolinas a lot. And whenever I was there, I'd spend a night at the beach house with them. And my dad and I started talking. And my friend Mike Way, who passed away a couple of years ago, he was my prayer partner. And when I was about 11 years sober, he came to me and he said, he moved from North Carolina. He was sober about 3 years. He said, I'm looking for a prayer partner. You be my prayer partner? I said, I don't pray much. And he said, I'll pray you partner. And he was an amazing man. And he did so much for me. And we had such interesting experiences. And I told him I had a hard time making amends to my dad. He said, honor your father. He said, honor him. Stop arguing with him. You don't have to prove he's wrong, you know, and all that stuff. And so that's what I started doing. And my dad talked to me when I was down there at the beach house. And he said, remember that when you went to work? I said, yeah, Dad, I was 12 years old. I worked in the bowling alley setting pins. And he said, you know, before you went to work, he said, I took you to Louis' hot dog stand. He said, remember what you had? I said, a hot dog? And he said, of course. He said, but you remember what you drank? And I said, I always drank orange pop. He said, not that day. He said, I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who worked drank root beer, so you ordered a root beer. And then he told me how to treat my employee, to work hard, you know, my employer. And he said, if you treat him with respect and you work hard, he'll respect you. And so he's telling his little boy how to grow up. And he took me down to the bus stop, and he said, you want me to go with you the first day? And he said, no thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself. And he said, I watched the bus till it was out of sight, and you never looked back. And he said, from then on, you never let me help you. You put yourself through high school. You put yourself through college. He said, all your brothers and sisters let me help them. And he said, you never let me help you. And, you know, he was put on earth to be a husband and a father. And I didn't let him be a father. And so the next month I came through town and I borrowed $1,000 from him. And I put it in a bank. And 2 months later I gave it back to him. And from then on we were just like that. And, you know, my brother Terry was also an alcoholic. And he ended up in the hospital. He had been a really good professional boxer and everything, and alcoholism took everything away from him. And he's ended up living in a basement of houses like I did and all that stuff. And he ends up with lung cancer. And so I drove up from North Carolina to be with him. And he asked me the kind of question you might want to ask your big brother. He's lying in a bed. He's very frail and everything. And he said to me, he said, do you really believe there's a God? I said, Terry, I know that's more true than anything I've ever known in my life. And he said, you think he could care about a guy like me? I said, Terry, he loves you so very, very much. And, you know, I gave him a rosary and a scapular and all that stuff. And I'd always wanted to hug him. I could never find him. Whenever I went home, he'd disappear. And so I asked him, I said, can I hug you? And he got out of bed. He was very shaky. And I hugged him just for a few seconds. And, you know, I also took a degree in theology out of Georgetown University, and I'm driving back down to North Carolina, and this lesson I had learned hit me in the head. It said there are two kinds of time. There's something called chronos, which is chronological time, which is linear. Then there's something called kairos, which is God's time. And the old-timers always said to me, you can only know God in the present. You can know about him in the past, but you can only know him in the present. And it made a huge difference in my life. And you know, my brother Terry, when I left, I helped him back into bed. And he said to me, he said, I think I can be just like you. I don't think I have to drink anymore. And I told him, you call me, collect, whenever you want to talk. And he did. And, you know, the day after my 20th AA birthday, on May the 14th, 1993, My mother walked into his bedroom, and he's sitting in a rocking chair, dead, with a rosary in his hand that I'd given him. That's the way I want to go. I want to be talking to God when I go. And he didn't drink for 6 months, and he talked to me a lot on the phone. And I talked to him about making amends because he had stolen things from everybody in the family. And he bought them tiny little trinkets and things like that and gave them to him to make amends. It was just incredible. And then shortly after that, my mother contracted cancer. And, you know, like I say, I sent a token to my mother and father every year with a thank you note. And my mother listed some of the things she wanted in her coffin. At the top of the list was my 23-year chip. And then some years later, my father's 89 years of age, and he's pretty sick. And so I went to see him. And he was such a humble man. And I said to him, he showed me the picture I had never seen, the high school baseball championship, Ohio baseball championship. I said, "Dad, I heard you were a pretty good ball player." He said, "I was okay." And I said, "I heard you were all state." He said, "Well, yeah, all 4 years." And I said, "I heard you were offered a professional contract." He said, "Actually, I was offered three." He said, "But Mom and Dad were sick, and I had a job in a factory, and they needed me at home." Here's a man who would give up his life's dream to take care of his parents. And then before I left, I got down and I took his hand in my hand and I said, "Daddy, is there anything we need to say to one another?" He said, "No, son, I know you love me and you know I love you." And then I got up, I gave him a kiss and I started to leave. He said, "There's one thing I want to say to you." And I said, "What's that, Dad?" He said, "I want to tell you that because of your friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, you are without a doubt the finest man I've ever known in my life." And I started to cry, and I went back and hugged him. And 2 months later, he's on his deathbed, and Julia and I went up to see him. And we're all around the bed, and we prayed with him. And I got down and, you know, took his hand and put it next to my heart, and I whispered in his ear, "It's okay to go, Dad. I'll pray for everything you pray for every day." And from 2001 until now, I've done that. And we prayed the Lord's Prayer, and when we said amen, my father squeezed my hand and he went into eternity. And I walked out of the room with tears in my eyes, and I said to Julia, "I'm not supposed to live like this. I'm supposed to be down the street trying to drink up enough courage to come here. But of course I'm supposed to live like this, because this is exactly how you taught me to live. I owe everything to Alcoholics Anonymous." And one more fast story. 1979, I had bought a townhouse out in Tacoma Park, Maryland, and my friend Mike Way bought one next to mine. And I got a call from the Intergroup office, and there was a huge gas shortage in 1979. Remember that? And it was, they had lines blocks long. And so they said, "Would you go to Bethesda? We need a 12-step call." And I said, "I'm almost out of gas." I said, "But we'll take care of it," because I had four people who lived in these 7-10 houses. Four of us were sober. And so I went to each door, and then I went to Mike's, and I said to Mike, I said, "Can I borrow your truck to go to Bethesda to do a 12-step call?" He said, "I'm out of gas completely." He said, "We had to push it into the parking lot." And he said, "Why don't you go, and I'll pray for you." So I got in my car, and I drove to Bethesda. And I go to this guy's house, and the guy is really in bad shape. And so I got him in a car, and I said to God, "If you let me get him to the hospital, I don't care what happens to me." And so I got him to the hospital, and he convulsed in the waiting room, so they took him in. And it's about 1 o'clock in the morning now, and I'm driving up Old Georgetown Road, and I cross Wisconsin Avenue, and there's a service station on a corner, and I see the guy in the office, so I pull up next to the pump, because the needle's buried below empty. And a guy came out and said, "We're closed." I said, "I know, but I'm going to sit here till you open." He said, "Don't do that. There'll be a huge line." He said, "I'll fill up your car." And so he filled up my car. And he said to me, he said, "There's something wrong with my pump." He said, "Your car only holds 21.5 gallons of gas." He said, "But it took 23.5 gallons. I said, "God loaned me 2 gallons of gas. I want to pay for him." And it terrified him. You know, so I drove back home and I park and I'm walking by Mike Way's house, and Mike's in there on his knees praying. And I went and went in the house and I told him, I said, you prayed me through this whole thing. I said, I am so profoundly grateful. And he said to me, he said, you know, if you had gone to Bethesda to have an adulterous relationship, you'd have run out of gas. He said, but as long as you do God's work and God's will, you're going to be okay. And, you know, that's precisely what happened. And you know, I have had a life that is blessed beyond my wildest dreams. And I married an absolutely wonderful woman, Julia. She's a great Al-Anon. And she's also very funny. She retired as a chief probation officer in Wilmington, North Carolina. Prior to that, she was a police officer. And we did a workshop one time on relationships, and she was talking about what attracts people to one another. And she said, the reason Keith fell in love with me is I'm the first woman he ever met who had her own handcuffs. She's a funny lady. She really is. She's terrific. And I'm blessed beyond my wildest dreams. And, you know, every year when I do my annual house cleaning, Mike and I used to do it. We used to go on silent retreats and do them. And he pointed out to me, he said, you know, you've always done well in your work life. Why is that? And I realized the reason was because I always knew exactly what was expected of me because I had a job description. So he said to me, why don't you write a job description as a husband, as a father of adult children, as a grandfather, as an AA member, as a sponsor? And so I wrote like 7 or 8 different job descriptions for the role that God has given me. And every year I evaluate myself, and every year I try to improve just a little bit in every area of my life. You know, when I was newly sober and I just came back to the hospital, I met this beautiful redheaded woman who was 30 years old and I was 29, and she had leukemia. And they did a bone marrow on her, and I grew the cells and everything. And she's the way her head's facing, she's looking at me. And she had tears in her eyes, and she said, you know, I got this disease, and my husband took my 2 boys and left me. And I'm thinking, I got this disease, and my wife took my 2 girls and left me. You know, and she said, I'll do anything if I can be well. And she died a month later, but I spent a lot of time with her. And we talked a lot about, you know, that sort of thing. And I was so profoundly grateful to her because she convinced me. And, you know, when I moved to North Carolina in 1980 to open another treatment center, I'm sitting on a balcony of my little apartment. I'm overlooking the lake. And every day I read the big book, and I read the big, big book, the Bible. And I'm sitting there reading, and I'm overwhelmed with gratitude. And I said, Father, why me? And I hearkened back to when I was in that treatment center. I called my estranged wife, and I said to her, I said, I'm an alcoholic. She said, no kidding. And I said, why me? She said, why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do. And you know, I'm asking God of my understanding, why me? And I heard him say, if anybody deserves it, you do. And, you know, a big part of the 11th step is I look back in my life and I see how God had his hand on me the whole time. And, you know, one of the things that really struck me was in 1953, on July the 13th, I was knighted into an organization called the Knights of Fatima. That was an apparition in Portugal in 1917. And the bishop said, the worst day of your life, the Mother of God will be there for you. 20 years to the day later, I'm in the process of taking my life, May the 13th, 1973. And a woman spoke to me, and I'm utterly convinced it was her. I'm so profoundly grateful to be part of this, and I want to thank you very much. Bye.